Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring guest speaker Dr. Peter Gross. Thanks to Dr. Gross and to everyone who has joined us in person and online. My name is Sarah Mitchell. I'm a professor in political science here at University of Iowa and also a member of the Iowa City Foreign Council Relations Program Committee. Now I'm going to briefly introduce our speaker, Dr. Peter Gross. He's a professor emeritus and former director of the University of Tennessee School of Journalism and Electronic Media. He's now an adjunct faculty member here at the University of Iowa's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's a longstanding columnist for Transitions Online, a Czech-based journal concentrated on East and Central Europe. And he's also the author of 12 books, including Entangled Evolutions, Media and Democratization in Eastern Europe, and Media Transformations in the Post-Communist World, Eastern Europe's Tortured Path to Change. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gross, who will talk about Russia's persistent disinformation and propaganda war against the West.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to speak at the Foreign Relations, Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. It's a pleasure to talk about an issue that keeps me young and keeps me involved. The topic, as you've heard, is Russia's disinformation and propaganda. It is something that is with us and will continue to be with us for quite a while. Disinformation is purposeful deception, and it should not be misunderstood as misinformation, which can be purposeful, but it's usually just a matter of getting things wrong and not doing the full job, at least from a journalist's perspective. And propaganda, of course, is a form of hyped misinformation used to promote or publicize a particular point of view, whether that's on the political side or economic or anything else in between. All three may be used and are used by Russia. They intersect, they parallel each other. We must remember that all biased information can be considered disinformation or misinformation or propaganda, or as we have begun calling it in 2016, fake news. That's fine. It makes it simple for everybody. Russian disinformation is aggressive. It is offensive as well as defensive in nature. And it has an apocalyptic quality to it. That is, many of the messages that Russia puts out have a feeling of a threatened kingdom, of threatened value, of an evil dragon, and obviously with Russia as a hero fighting this terrible situation in the world. The Soviets have been addicted to information, and now the Russians are continuing that pattern. What I have put up here is an exchange between Yuri Andropov, who was the Secretary General of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union for a while, and also KGB chairman, and Ion Pacepa, who was a Romanian general in the Romanian version of the KGB, who ultimately defected to the U.S. and has written some wonderful things that essentially show us the nature of disinformation that the Soviets and ultimately the Russians are practicing, and the importance to the point where it becomes addictive. And I should inject one little piece of news for those of you who may not have heard this. On October 28th, which was just a few days ago, the Russian representative to the UN made a presentation that said the Russians have discovered that the Americans have worked up a new drone for use in Ukraine that flies over the Russian troops and releases mosquitoes carrying pathogens. How they train those mosquitoes, they haven't said, but obviously it is another bit of disinformation that falls into this category of we are addicted to it and therefore we're going to do it on almost a daily basis, including Russian journalists, Russian media, Russian politicians, and any and all who essentially speak for Russia in one way or another. So this addiction is indeed a serious one, and it has consequences. The RAND Corporation called Russia's disinformation a fire hose of falsehood. And I love that title. It sort of encompasses all that needs to be said about Russian disinformation in a way. It is relentless. It is repetitive. It is ubiquitous. And the ubiquity of their disinformation is tied first and foremost to the advent of the digital media. And we'll talk about this a little later on. It is purposefully contradictory. For example, the Russians will put out two or three or four or five stories on the same theme. None of them are true, but it leaves audiences debating which one is true, thus neutralizing them in a way from actually pursuing what the real facts are in a particular story on that theme. And that contradictory nature of this information seems to be accepted by audiences. That's one of the things that has been shown to work. It has a set agenda, of course, but one of its hallmarks is that it's flexible. It's opportunistic. It's situational. And I'll give you an example from just a few years ago in 2019, just before COVID hit. Relations between Turkey and the United States really soured at that point. There were some verbal clashes, let's say. So the Russians put out a story that because of that, America's nuclear bombs stored in Turkey are being moved to Romania. And the story that they put out essentially made it clear that it's happening now as we speak. Now, we all know that nuclear bombs can't just be packed in a backpack and taken across borders. But this was the implication. And it was meant to rile up the Romanians, of course. You know, nuclear weapons in our country, let's not deal with that. Luckily, it didn't have that much of an effect. So this is the flexible part of Russian disinformation. The refugee crisis in Europe was another one of those situational opportunities. And the Russians put out stories that it is the U.S. who has actually created this immigration crisis in Europe because Europe was presenting too much of an economic competition to the U.S. Okay. The themes are always the same. The pandemic that started in 2020. The message from the Russians was it originated in the U.S. lab. That was easy to guess that they were going to do that, right? Not hard at all. And it sort of dovetails with what they've done in the past, for example. If you remember when the AIDS pandemic started, they said it was the CIA who spread AIDS in Africa. And then from there, it was spread across the world. This information is also non-ideological. During the Soviet era, obviously, it was purely ideological. They did things in order to emphasized the legitimacy of the communist regime, for one thing. For another, they wanted to spread that ideology. Now it's not ideological at all. They disseminate information that, in effect, props up left-wing groups, props up right-wing groups. Whichever groups can make more trouble in a particular country will get informational support from the Russians through this disinformation. It is also very cultural specific and very country specific. The Russians know full well what the issues are in every country, both domestic issues as well as international issues. So one of the things, for example, that they've done when they invaded Crimea is they published a number of stories in the Hungarian press reminding them that they lost Transylvania to Romania after World War I. They did the same in Romania, but with a little bit of a different twist. That yes, they got Transylvania after World War I, but it's an issue that's still open to debate. Okay? Sometimes they can be very subtle. Most of the time, they're not that subtle in their disinformation. So they play on words, whether they're connotative or denotative meaning. And I'm sure all of you noticed that when they invaded Ukraine, they said it's not an invasion, it's not a war, it's just a special operation. I need not go any further than that to illustrate that particular point. And it addresses and encourages all sorts of biases and beliefs and emotions, sometimes in very silly ways and sometimes in ways that could possibly make trouble. And they're probing all the time. This information is not something they're throwing out there with any sort of security that it will be successful. They amplify messages sort of in a shotgun approach to see what sticks and what doesn't stick. And if something sticks, it might help them. If not, we'll go along, we'll either repeat it or come up with something new. That's essentially the pattern. So, digital media. This is their strong point right now. This allows them to disseminate their messages like never before, when only traditional media was available. First of all, because traditional media, particularly in the Western countries, more or less, of course, not equally across the board, were gatekeepers. They had fact checkers, they had editors who paid attention to what was true and what was not true. And there was a bit of control, or at least a countermeasure by way of journalism that would say, so-and-so said this, we checked it, and it's not true. Digital media doesn't have that. There are no gatekeepers. They claim to have fact checkers. I doubt that, and it also depends on who's checking those facts and where those facts are checked. So digital media is dangerous, and it's very useful to disinformation. It's dangerous to the rest of us. They can put out anything. They have bots. They have trolls. They'll put stuff out. They don't need to explain it. The bots disappear, the trolls disappear, new ones surface the next day with different messages or the same messages, and on it goes. It creates echo chambers, and that's probably the biggest problem. People get on the internet, on social media of all sorts, as we all know, and they seek out groups that essentially send messages or exchange messages that agree with their beliefs, that agree with their attitudes, that agree with their hatreds, that agree with their loves, that agree with anything at all. Social media serves them very well, and the Russians are taking advantage of that. It's all a matter of storytelling, right? And the themes are always the same. The major themes are always the same, and I've listed them here. Russia is an innocent victim. The message here is that Russia has always been a victim. It's always been invaded. There was Napoleon, there was Hitler, and then the West, who was against the Soviet Union, in other words, Russia, and therefore they're always a victim. It is Russophobia that drives the West and drives everything that the West does in regard to Russia, and therefore they're continuous victims. The notion that Russia has a great past and that the West is trying to revise that downwards, of course, in the negative. Of course, the Russians are also involved in revisionism. For example, the Soviet Union didn't invade Poland in 1939. Blatantly false, right? Or the Baltic countries, or Finland. It's a sort of revisionism that the Russians do continuously. Soviet soldiers didn't rape and pillage during World War II as they passed from one country to the other. I can tell you that they did. There's plenty of evidence of that. They're trying to disclaim this sort of action. And it always comes around at the time when the world is celebrating the anniversary of the end of World War II. So 2 years ago, when it was the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, they distributed these sort of stories, certainly all over Eastern Europe, but in some parts of Western Europe as well, Germany, for example. So they revived a story that essentially was already dead, but I guess they're still feeling the effects of it or feel the need to say, no, we didn't do any of that. And they turned things around. What happened after 1989, when communism fell apart in Central and Eastern Europe? NATO invaded their former fraternal countries. That was the line, okay? The line is always that the West is causing victims, okay? The EU is there essentially to eliminate the sovereignty of other European countries. That is a recurring theme as well. EU is bad, pushed by the US, pushed by NATO, of course, and that extends to other things as well. Popular movements are all U.S.-sponsored, the color revolutions that we've seen in their part of the world, but also in the Arab Spring, for example, in the Middle East. This was all the U.S. is doing. They egged things on in order to make trouble for those countries. And there's no change in those themes. They're just put in different contexts. So Russia's disinformation has what has been described as a once upon a time kind of feel to it. That is, their threatened values, Christianity is threatened, stability is threatened, and that means that the world needs a savior, which is Russia, of course. There is a threatened kingdom, that apocalyptic element that I spoke of. And there is a threat to traditional values, which is why Russia is fighting Western decay and decadence, feminism, LGBTQ movements, all of these are just terrible. They're destroying the world, and Russia is there as a bastion of resistance to all of that. And they have a set list of the baddies, right? We have the Vatican, we have the liberals in general, we have George Soros, who's a threat. The Rothschilds, of course, who are a threat. I don't even know if there's any Rothschild family left. Perhaps there is. I don't know. The British Empire, still. There is no more British Empire, but the British Empire is brought up as a threat. The Zionist, of course, and anybody and everybody who will dissent from Russia. All of these create a world in which there are helpless people, and Russia is here to rescue them. This is why Russian disinformation has this feel of a nice story, of a bedtime story. The threatened kingdom, the helpless people, the bad guys, or the dragon, and the savior. Moscow is the new Sparta, in fact. And I will give you some examples just from this last month. Examples that are very instructive in a way, if I can get this out. So some of the headlines from stories that Russia put out all over the world, but particularly in their region in Western Europe. EU leaders gave Ukrainian Nazis money to buy weapons. Kiev is developing a dirty bomb with the help of the US and NATO. Russia does not have chemical weapons because it destroyed them all in 2017. Well, that's patently false. They destroyed those that they had declared, but not those that they had not declared. Let's see, what else? Ukraine never existed before the 20th century, and it was simply created by the Bolsheviks. Zelensky's team is a bloody dictatorship waging the civil war in Ukraine, and the videos that you see of Zelensky in dangerous places are actually filmed in a studio. This gives you a feel for the kind of stuff that Russia puts out. Lots of innuendos, lots of accusations about dirty bombs and so forth, none of which are really true. Ukraine, for example, is hoarding grain, and therefore the world is starving. Or another version on the same theme is that the EU is hoarding Ukrainian grain, and therefore the rest of the world is going to starve. So again, contradictory messages on the same theme that has you discuss which might be true, which of these untrue stories might be true. And this continues ad nauseum. So, who are the targets? First of all, former Soviet republics. It's a continuous 24/7 sort of information attack, part of their hybrid warfare or information warfare that they prosecute in the former Soviet republics. The West in general, the US in particular, the Middle East, given that they foment as much trouble as possible over there, East and Central Europe. This is very important to them because not all, but most East and Central European countries have joined NATO and have joined the EU, and they feel threatened by that, and therefore they attack East and Central Europe with their disinformation war on an almost daily, on a weekly basis. NATO, of course, the British Empire, which I have mentioned already, they have something about the British Empire, even though it doesn't exist anymore. And then there is the rest of the world, and Russian citizens themselves. We talk about this information, of course, on the international level, but Russian disinformation directed at their own citizens is extensive, it's continuous, and it starts with one element that is indeed part of this information, that is deception, censorship. Censorship and the creation of a self-censorship atmosphere is part of this information, and we pay attention to it, of course, and address it sometimes, and forget it some other times. That's unfortunate. What are the goals? Well, first of all, to confuse. Confusion is good because then nobody pays attention to them, to the Russians, that is. Befuddle, sow divisions, distract, provoke, encourage xenophobia, ethnic, racial, religious hatred. This is a patented sort of way of disseminating information that is meant to achieve a certain goal. Inject or encourage conspiracy theories. I'll give you one example. When the Russian ship Moskva was sunk in the Black Sea just a few months ago, they put out different stories. There was a fire on board. There was a bomb on board. The Ukrainians sank it. NATO sank it. So, again, different stories, conspiracy theories all the way that they feel helped them. It was the same situation when the submarine Kursk sank in 2000. They put out stories that it was sunk by a NATO vessel, and they continue that over a period of time to see if they can make some trouble that way. They didn't, which is not surprising. They call Europe Gay Europa to push this theme that the values of Christianity are being murdered, as they say, and continue with anti-Semitism, continue with a number of other themes that essentially is meant not to necessarily incite, but to use the existing incitement at the local level against one group or another. They want to distract and provoke, of course, as I said. Ukraine's democratically elected government is, according to Russian disinformation, a gang of drug addicts and neo-Nazis. That is the wording. It continues. Purposes. I listed only five. These are the major ones that we can identify. They want to undermine confidence in leaders, therefore they will attack Western leaders, all of those who at least are not quiet about what Russia is doing or are outright against them. Influence the policies of other countries. The stories about the Ukrainian non-war endangering Europe's gas supplies or food supplies is meant to influence these other countries who Russia hopes will say, okay, then we won't back Ukraine anymore, or at least we'll keep quiet or something of the sort. Disrupt relations among nations. This is a standard theme anyway that has been identified for years and years now. It has to do with everything from usual diplomatic exchanges to how NATO countries work with one another. Discredit and weaken opponents, of course. Again, pretty much standard. And erode support for European values. Democracy is bad. Democracy doesn't work in Europe anymore. Liberal values get you to gay Europa, and that's sort of a string of messages over and over again. Collaborators. There are witting and there are unwitting collaborators in this scenario. I mentioned bots and trolls before. Those are sort of set pieces. They're journalists, and I'm not talking about Russian journalists who, of course, don't have much choice. They don't have freedom of expression or freedom of the press over there. I'm talking about Western journalists who, like hungry fish, will sometimes bite on some of these nasty worms that Russia puts out. Academics. Russians invaded Crimea, and a number of academics wrote essentially pieces that, if they did not support the invasion itself, they explained it as the Russians would have explained it. And I'll get to that a bit later. Politicians. Okay. If you think about what Angela Merkel did in Germany before she left her office, what she said at the time that the Crimea was invaded, at the time that Ukraine was invaded, you see how they... how she unwittingly supported Russia. And I must say, Biden. Remember what President Biden said when Russia invaded Ukraine, or was about to invade Ukraine. He said something that his reaction, our reaction, will depend on just how far Russia got into Ukraine. You know, how big of a chunk he would take. Well, that's not a good message when you're dealing with somebody like Putin and Russia. They're non-governmental collaborators. They're organizations that collaborate, again, wittingly or unwittingly. States and governments, obviously. I just read something last week about Iran not only sending drones and Turkey not only sending drones, but now Iranians are shipping ammunition to the Russians because the Russians are not producing enough of their own. Russophiles, of course, people who are so enamored with the Russians and with their mentalities, which are essentially authoritarian, they will support them. And audiences. Audiences gravitate to this information if and when they feel that their beliefs, their attitudes, their likes and dislikes and hatreds and loves are being supported by this information. It's a way of averring their positions on certain things, and therefore they collaborate in that way. This information is not successful if audiences are not collaborating. If they're more inquisitive, if they're more questioning, then they can't collaborate. We don't always have that. So, there are two success stories, qualified, of course, that Russian disinformations have had in the last few years. One is the notion that we shouldn't provoke Russia into attacking Ukraine. When in fact they have stated, Putin has stated since 2000 when he took control of Russia, that he wants to reconstitute the Soviet Empire or the Russian Empire. It was never quite clear as to which. And the second theme or topic on which I think there was some success is the notion that Russia's aim is simply to avoid being encircled by NATO. So I'll touch on both of those. Putin, as I said, has wanted to reconstitute an empire for a very long time. He said that in the State of the Nation address, Russian State of the Nation address, in 2005. He repeated it in 2018 when he spoke to the Federal Assembly, at which time the Duma was present and others as well, that he wants to change the course of modern history by recreating his empire. And he hasn't changed his mind. So why is it that we did not take him on his word? Why is it that we continued at all sorts of levels, journalistic, academic, and government, whether it was the US or whether it was some Western European countries, to say we shouldn't provoke him, when he already had in mind to do what he was going to do? He did not need any provocation. What needed to happen is not to think that we will provoke him, but to think how to stop him. That didn't happen. So Russia had some success, you might argue, in this regard, with their disinformation, in talking people into believing that indeed we should not provoke Russia. Let me also remind you, let's set aside what Putin has said since 2000 when he took power, and look at what Russia has done since 1991. 8 mini wars, if you will. South Ossetia, which is part of Georgia, Abkhazia, which is also part of Georgia in 1992, Moldova and Transnistria in 1992. Transnistria is a little sliver of Moldova, where the 14th Russian Army is still present, and which, by the way, the Russians have said after invading Ukraine that they will try to build a bridge to Transnistria over Ukraine. And the expectation, of course, was that what they really meant was to take Moldova, under the same sort of excuse that they marched into Ukraine. Protecting the Russian minority. There is a Russian minority in Transnistria, indeed, and Moldova, because they were being discriminated against, and genocide was happening, not just in Ukraine, but in Transnistria and Moldova, trying to get rid of the Russians. So Chechnya, 2 wars there, mini wars, 1994 and 1999, and Chechnya is indeed again controlled by Russia now. Georgia proper in 2008, Crimea in 2014, and of course Ukraine in 2022. Again, the question is, why did so many people bite on this notion that we should not provoke Putin? He didn't need any provocation. The plans were set, in a way. Russia's expansion during the last 2 years, again, don't provoke. They took over Belarusian security apparatus and the media. Russian troops were stationed in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a region of Azerbaijan. And they also took over Kazakhstan security forces and media. So again, don't provoke. Don't provoke him to do what? Lastly, in November of 2021, just about a year ago, Russia said it will not invade Ukraine, quote, unless provoked. Clever, I think. January 2022, Russia will not invade Ukraine, but, again, there is a but, an unless. The U.S. and NATO have left little room for compromise after ignoring his demands. What were his demands? That NATO not expand. Ukraine had not applied for NATO membership, and there was no talk within NATO of having Ukraine join. March 2022, Russia has not invaded Ukraine and will not invade any other country. There is evidence to indicate that Ukraine planned to attack the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, those enclaves that wanted to break away and where they had the sham election just a few weeks ago. So again, there was a but. April 2022, a top Russian general has raised the prospect that a breakaway Moscow-aligned part of Moldova is next in the Kremlin's sights in its invasion of Ukraine. Yes, well, we knew that because they've said that before. And finally, the latest, of course, is that Russia, just this last month, the statement was made that Russia will not use nuclear weapons. Maybe not, but then we don't know, right? I mean, there's no way to tell what the Russians will or will not do. So, on the issue of NATO expansion, and I think this was probably the most successful disinformation campaign, because again, so many people kept repeating then, Western journalists, Western politicians, Western academics, that Ukraine simply doesn't want NATO expansion because it does not want to be surrounded by NATO countries. If you look at the map, Russia has two NATO members on its border right now. If you look at the far left side of the map, you see Estonia and Latvia, Baltic countries who are members of NATO, right? Now, if Russia invaded Ukraine so as not to be encircled by NATO countries, and Russia is successful in taking over Ukraine, then it will have the following country, NATO countries on its borders: Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Slovenia, Hungary, and Romania. So if I want not to be encircled by NATO countries, and I have two of them on my border now, I certainly wouldn't invade Ukraine, because now I have six NATO members on my borders. Furthermore, the invasion of Ukraine, as we all know, drove Finland and Sweden to apply for membership in NATO. Assuming that Belarus is going to be incorporated into Russia, which is not certain, but Lukashenko in Belarus is sort of vacillating, and Russia is still pushing, it's conceivable that Russia will have even more NATO countries on its border, meaning, first and foremost, Lithuania. So that has been a fairly successful disinformation campaign if you look at all the journalism on the topic in the West, the academic writing in the West, some academic writing in the West, and some pronouncements by politicians in the West and governments in the West. So what is the future of Russian disinformation? Well, more of the same. What you see there is a Chinese cartoon in English distributed that essentially makes fun of Ukraine. Glory belongs to Ukraine, and you have the Nazi flags, and then the American flag, the British flag, the Korean flag, the Japanese flag, and so forth, right at the bottom. This isn't going to stop. This is going to continue. Giving me and many others more reasons to keep working, even though we're retired. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now move to the question and answer portion of our program. For those in the room, you can raise your hand and we'll bring a microphone to you. For those who are watching online, You can text your questions to 319-600-2588. Again, that's 319-600-2588.
So, Dr. Gross, we have a question online. The questioner asks, it seems less like we didn't believe Putin and more that many, especially on the right, embraced him and his actions. Why and what can we do?
Thank you for the question. It's a good question. Why did they embrace what Putin was saying? For a number of different reasons. And it happened both on the right and on the left, if we include Europe as well. Four different reasons. Political in some cases, ideological in other cases. We believed him, and there was no reason to. And there is not much we can do other than better educate people as to what Putin is all about and what Russia is all about today. We also need to delve a little deeper into Russian culture and Russian history to understand why there is this authoritarian streak. That is very important. We tend to look at politics and foreign relations and a number of other issues simply in terms of what is happening on the ground, so to speak, and not look behind the scenes at what the impetuses are for certain attitudes and for certain mentalities. In other words, we don't look at culture, and I think we should. This is how, for example, before the fall of the Soviet Union in 1992, before the fall of East Central European communism in 1989, we paid attention to Sovietologists, as they were called, who looked at data, numbers. They didn't look at the larger context of the culture in the societies of East Central Europe, for example. They didn't look at the fact that people had simply had enough and lost their fear. Fear is what glued together the ability of communist regimes to stay in power. And to some extent, the same was true in the Soviet Union. Different, to be sure, but to some extent the same. We didn't pay attention to those things. So we missed the fact that East and Central Europe was going to disintegrate. The communist regimes were going to disintegrate. In fact, I made a presentation in 1985 in California after taking a trip through Eastern Europe and talking to people. One by one, since they were always afraid. And what I said is that sometime by the end of the century, the communist regimes in Eastern Europe would fall apart. I had probably about 100, 150 in the audience, and I would probably say that 99% laughed. And they brought up articles and books written by our Sovietologists and European Sovietologists, although they weren't called that, who essentially said no, that this will it will never end over there. We need to look behind the scenes. We need to look at what pushes certain policies, what pushes certain attitudes, what pushes certain behaviors, what pushes certain practices. And that is culture, values, beliefs, and so forth. Those are the things that affect what is actually happening. What happens is, and what we see is the front of in front of the curtain of the theater and not behind the curtain.
I have another question online, then I'll get to the ones in the room, okay? So can social media platforms do anything practically or in terms of the law to thwart Russian disinformation from having a strong impact in the United States?
There is an attempt to do that, right? We have algorithms to supposedly can detect disinformation from Russians or anybody else. These are not foolproof measures, though, to detect anything. Who is putting together these algorithms? How do they define this information? How do they, we talk about keeping hatred out of the social media. How do you define hatred? I mean, there are a number of ways I can define hatred. If I'm on the left, I can define hatred a certain way. If I'm on the right, I can define hatred a certain way. If I'm in the middle of the political spectrum, I can define hatred a certain way. Nothing is foolproof. So there's not much you can do beyond absolute censorship. And that doesn't work, and we should never have censorship. I don't believe in censorship. My background is Eastern European. I was born in a communist country, where censorship was a minute-by-minute affair. I don't believe in any censorship. So that's not a solution. So there's not much we can do with social media. We can have better media literacy programs. We can, in fact, have better education. And for that, we need to make sure that our education is not politicized, because politicized education feeds into the possibility that this information will be successful. There's not much we can do. But whatever we can do, we should do.
Thank you for the opportunity. As you point out, I do believe there's Russian disinformation campaign globally, not just here directed to the U.S., but it seems to me for whatever the Russians are doing, as far as disinformation and misinformation, whatever they're doing, for it to be dangerous enough, there must be a receptive audience. Mm-hmm. And you've pointed this out. Mm-hmm. So this receptiveness, it seems to me, comes from there being at least some element of a grain of truth, perhaps, in all this blatant lies they're spreading. Now, my question to you is, do you believe some of the policies the West adapts help lend credence to some of the things they're saying? For example, you pointed out the Russians always go on and on about the West not having any regard for other countries' sovereignties, right? And then they can point to the list of countries invaded by the U.S. or in which the U.S. intervened. So are U.S. and also other Western governments responsible for some of the policies? Because it lends credence to some of the stuff they're saying. I'm not saying all the stuff they're saying, but at least some of it.
I think the obvious answer is that, yes, there are certain policies and there are certain realities in Western societies that open up the possibility for their use in Russian disinformation. More so in propaganda. Propaganda always revolves around the kernel of truth. That is then either twisted or built up in such a way as to meet the goals of that piece of propaganda. With disinformation is somewhat the same, but not quite. Disinformation is really, in the true sense of the word, fake news. Yeah. NATO gobbling up or invading former fraternal Soviet countries, mosquitoes being released to bite only Russian soldiers, obviously, that will then help the Ukrainians. So this information has much more of a fake quality to it than propaganda, which always revolves around some kernel of truth. So the quick answer to you is yes. I mean, there are those situations. Of course, definitions of invasion, for example, from the Russian point of view, will be a bit twisted too. Okay. What we did during the Yugoslav conflict in the 1990s, we bombed the Serbs in order to stop them attacking not only Croatia, but the Muslims in Bosnia. Okay. Russian disinformation hammers at that this is evidence that we are, invading or attacking another country, and the Serbs, of course, are allies of Russia most of the time. So again, definitions count, right? And who comes up with those definitions? You're basically right.
Okay. I think we're at the end of our program. I was going to say that maybe I'll just give this back to you. I have a comment and a question. I guess the comment is that the Biden administration has been pretty proactive in putting out these knowledge of false flag operations, not only with respect to Russia, but more generally. And I think that's a pretty effective strategy for combating this disinformation. But I guess my question is the different types of actors that are co-opted might matter, right? Because the academic example, you know, John Mearsheimer, professor at Chicago, loved by the Russians, but loved by the Chinese too.
Because
his theories are about U.S. and NATO expansion and aggression and responses to that. So I think co-opting well-known academics could help explain why you get success in that case. Mm-hmm. But I also think about co-opting groups like the NRA, so mm-hmm. infiltration mm-hmm. into groups that have credibility in a country, you know, can also, it seems like these indirect strategies are almost more effective than the bots and trolls.
No, absolutely right. And I mean, this is why I said their Russian disinformation is non-ideological. It will use any group that they think can make trouble in a particular country and help their cause, any group that might forward their messages in some form or another. They don't care who it is, okay? They absolutely don't care who it is as long as it helps them. And that, too, makes it more dangerous. That amplifies their disinformation even without the social media. Add the social media to that, and now you're really fighting a multi-front war. You're practically surrounded, and that makes it very, very difficult to defend against. You pointed out the Biden administration ramping up finally, not only identifying false flag operations and aid to Ukraine. Absolutely true. I think the Biden administration could probably have done more to stop Russia from so cavalierly walking into Ukraine and not have been seduced by the notion that we shouldn't provoke them. If we just keep quiet, don't provoke them, it won't happen. It was going to happen. That was a guarantee. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gross, for your excellent presentation. I'm honored to present you with the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's highly coveted mug for coffee, tea, or the beverage of your choice. Thanks for joining us today. We are adjourned.